All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
What's up, what's up, what's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove. With me, Team Supreme. Laia, hello, how are you?
I am well, excited, friend.
I know, right? Long time coming, long time coming. What you up to? What's going on out there?
Right now it's not raining, so that's a good thing. And that's what's going
on. Wait, time
on.
Out. It's been raining since, I mean, I was there for the Noah's flood of Grammy night. It's still been raining since?
I guess so. I wasn't. I left and went to Brazil on Grammy night. But I heard it has been, you heard that, Floss? You gotta drop it. I went to Salvador. Went to Salvador, so
You went to Brazil for Carnival?
For the best Carnival, yes. Yes.
What the hell?
Flex is that? Yeah. What?
Y'all that's flex so all the time. I flex once a year.
Wow. What was it like? Give me your 45-second report.
I mean, Salvador, if anybody doesn't know about Salvador, Brazil is beautifully black. It's the second largest black populated place outside of the continent. So it has all the flavor and all of the ways and just a lot. It was just beautiful. It was beautiful and fun. And the food tastes better there. Yeah. They say, just for you, so you know, the three different cities, you party in Rio and the people in Sao Paulo work so the people in Rio can party. And then, yeah, the black folks are in Salvador.
Okay. Right. You didn't go to Rio or the other spots?
No, I was where you really want to be. Amir, Salvador is the best place to go for Carnival. I said it's where the black people are who started it.
Oh. I didn't know. I'm a product of the Philadelphia High School public curriculum. So
yeah, but you're a world traveler.
I know. I just go to my hotel, eat my.
All right. Well, we got some things to do. We got some. I would love to take all of y'all to Salvador.
Well, yeah, you gotta let us know next time you going.
You right.
Yeah, we gotta go there to do the Arthur Verikai episode. That's
stay what? Tell me, Fonte, what now?
Oh, the Arthur Verikai. Yes.
Do the Arthur Verikai episode. That's what we're doing.
By the way, how, you know, I didn't get to peep Heidi's Coyote's collaborative album with him. Is it, have you heard it or is it good?
I haven't listened yet either.
Okay. What's up, Steve? What's going on, man? How's life?
Great. I'm currently imagining a vacation with Laia to Salvador.
You need it. I need it bad.
Everything's great. Looking forward to this interview.
Here's a dumb question, Steve. I got to ask you a work question. Who's on the show today?
Jennifer Lopez and Alan Richson and Gary Clark Jr. But we had a great musical guest yesterday.
Who?
Brittany Howard.
Oh, I was, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I was not at work yesterday. You can't get mad at me, Brittany. I was not at work yesterday. I had to take a day off. Things were happening. Fonticola, what's good, man?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm excited to have Brittany here today, man. I can't wait to talk about this new album.
Hell yeah.
Shit is hard.
It's hard. Got me sweating already.
Wait, are you in California, Bill Sherman?
No, I'm in New Jersey. Also that's your California. Crib? Yes.
I mean, you're usually in the basement, so I was throwing
off. Yeah, So I'm not in Black Brazil. I have a house in New Jersey, and this is what it looks like from the kitchen.
I see. All right. That's what's up.
We got to teach Bill about light. You're supposed to be in front of you so we can see you.
I like being in shadows.
Bill's flexing of his window structure actually made me think he was on vacation somewhere. So I didn't realize that was just Jersey. ladies and gentlemen, our guest today, as everyone said, pretty much we've been waiting a long time for this one, and it's finally happened. She is a 5-time Grammy Award winner, and she basically pours her entire life experience into her songwriting, her music, her production. And, you know, she's just a star with an A-H at the end of the word star. She's practically worked with everyone, name it, from Prince to Verdine White to Lin-Manuel Miranda, John Legend. The list goes completely on and on and on. She has formed several successful bands, including one of my favorite, Alabama Shakes. Not to mention, she's here today to talk about her journey through life, her journey through love and music. And we're celebrating the release of her sophomore album entitled What Now? And welcome, Brittany Howard, to Questlove Supreme.
Yes, sir.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I had to do crystal bowls.
At long last. Hey, everybody. Good to be here.
At long last. Where are you right now, Britt?
I'm in the city. I'm looking out the window. Okay. Lower East Side.
Obviously, you're on the promotional run, or are you on an actual tour for your album?
I'm doing both at the same time. I'm on the promo run. I'm doing tour. That's what I'm out here doing.
As Fonte said, congratulations on the record. Like, it's really awesome to hear your artistic growth and you know, just the risk that you're taking. The album is incredible. And, you know, all the accolades that you're getting on it, congratulations are in order. We love this record.
Yeah. I want to personally thank you for To Be Still. Like, thank you for that record. Shit is beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
There's a level of envy I have when a person releases a new record, maybe because I'm constipated 10 years in holding my own record hostage. That was like everyone, like, you know, Gary Clark's records coming out, Brit's records coming out. We just had Kareem Bailey Ray, like all these albums are coming out and I'm like still holding my joint hostage. And like, so what is the feeling you feel when it's over and you know it's ready?
What do you mean, like when it comes out? How's that feel?
Well, yeah, when you're done, because for me, like albums are almost like your kids. I hold this close to the chest. I don't play demos for people. I don't say, hey, you want to hear a bit of that? Like, I'm so anxious feel on letting it go. And then there's a point where, like, whenever I always master a record, maybe like 2 weeks before it's really supposed to be turned in, because I almost have to have a mourning process in literally letting your kids go. And I want to know, do you go through that, or is this just like, hey, here are my 12, 13 songs and I'm ready?
Yeah, I feel like I understand where you're coming from. But for me, it's kind of the opposite. I'm like, I can't wait to get this out in the world, because you know how it is in this business. You have to do the whole album cycle. You have to do the touring and you have to do the promo and you do all of this for this album. And it's like, as soon as I finish an album, I can't wait to get it out. It's like a gestation process and what I imagine a very pregnant woman feels like. It's like, I'm ready for this thing to get out of me, you know, so I can move on with my life. And it's kind of what it's like. I'm very proud of this project, but I'm also very excited to start a new one as well.
Already.
Are you a song cycle person, or are you an album cycle person? Like, do you just write enough songs for the album to come, or is it, even as the album is done, you already have songs in the stash or still writing?
Like, there's still some on the cutting room floor. I think I still had like 6 or 7 that didn't make the album. And it was just because it was taking too long. Like, I was like, all right, I got enough here. I don't really want to spend any more energy working these out. I'll do this later. And I'm definitely like an album cycle person. Like, as soon as it feels like it, if it has the feel done, it has the feel cooked, and I feel like once I have that feeling, it's just like an intuition thing. Then I'm like, okay, here it is. This is it. Let's do the sequence.
What was the period of time between knowing when it was done, like just knowing like that feeling you were talking about of like, okay, I feel like this is complete, it's cooked. The time between that and it actually coming out and being released.
Sure. This time, it was like 10 months.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Well, like post-pandemic, things are still just taking a long time to create because we like vinyl. We like the objects when listening to music. It takes a long time to print those things.
Oh, yeah.
Everything's just slower. So it took a long time to get the whole shebang ready, really.
If this was like a meal, then how long was your meal prep and what was the preparation for this album in the sense that this album is going to say this? Do you even do all of that in your head?
No, I don't even think about that. It was just, I started this in March of 2020. So that's pretty much like shutdown. And I didn't realize I was making an album. I would just go in and just make like songs for fun because the world was terrifying. And we were all scared, so there's really nowhere to turn to. So it's just like, I used music as my outlet once again. And when I was making this album back in 2020, I didn't know I was making it. I was just like, it was like journal entries, you know? And I told myself, I'll just go in there. No matter what happens, it's okay. It doesn't matter what it sounds like. It doesn't matter the quality of it. It's just something to do. And so it's been cooking for such a long time. The meal prep has been insane. I had walked into the kitchen, cut vegetables, walked back out. You know what I mean?
Well, let me ask you, how close to March 13th, 2020, did you start the record?
So I had just finished a London tour, UK tour, flew from London, got to New York City, and we had Fallon lined up and we had different shows lined up we're going to do. And I was just looking at the state of things. I was like, I don't think none of this is going to happen. So I actually flew home, like on the 12th or the 13th. Like I got to Nashville and then everything shut down. And I feel like I started tinkering with things maybe like a month later. I just know like I finished Tiger King. And as soon as I finished Tiger King, I was like, all right, I don't have stuff to do. Like, I guess I'll go make music because I'm a musician.
Yeah. What did you think of Joe Exotic's songs in Tiger King?
Oh, shit.
I thought Here Kitty Kitty was a jam. Listen. Hey, fuck that. Here Kitty Kitty was a jam.
But it wasn't even him, right?
It wasn't even him.
Which makes it richer. Yeah. He just wanted to act it out.
Yeah.
What do I think about the songs? Honestly, as a body of work, I'm going to go ahead and give it a 6.
Okay.
A 6.
Out of 20. No, I'm waiting. A lot of these albums that I'm hearing sort of got their genesis or their beginning in 2020, and they're just coming out now, like 4 years later. I don't think it's a coincidence that for a lot of us, a lot of our art that we started creating in 2020, in sort of the midst of panic and the apocalypse, air quotes, the apocalypse, I don't think it's a coincidence. So I guess I'll ask you, how hard was it, or what was your relationship to creativity in the apocalypse? You know, because like people are dying in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Family members are getting sick in real time. And like all these things are happening. But for you, like, were you like fuck singing or like, and I mean like more like July, August, when we don't know if we're coming or going.
Yeah, I mean, my relationship with creativity was definitely difficult during that time. I was seeing like friends, especially on Instagram, just like having output. And I couldn't believe it. I was like kind of where I was, like I said, I was going in and out of making little songs. And when I say little songs, I mean, they're like 30 seconds. They're just little ideas. And I pushed myself to do that. But honestly, it was like doing anything creative was a survival mechanism for me. Couldn't go anywhere. Couldn't see my friends. Was always concerned about getting sick. Was concerned what was going to happen next. Because not only did we have the pandemic, but back in Nashville, we had just had a tornado that had kind of devastated the area where I was living.
Oh.
And it was like one thing after the other. And a lot of people, like, they didn't have roofs on their house. So people trying to help each other out at the same time. It's like an extremely stressful kind of like position to be in. So to me, the creativity was my lifeline to any normalcy whatsoever. And it wasn't like I needed to have output. And it wasn't like I needed to make anything great. It was just, I just needed to have any type of like control at all, really.
Another commonality in the pandemic was a pivot. Did you discover another talent that you had in the pandemic that you didn't realize you had?
Man, I think, you know, listen, I kind of rediscovered my love for fishing. Me and my dad used to fish when I was a little girl. And during that time, because I lived in the country, I could just go by myself and go fishing. And I kind of got good at that, I guess, if you can say you can get good at fishing. Yeah. Got good at standing there. And
you just got good patience. That's what that means.
Yeah,
since
yeah.
You
a Libra
there.
And a good fisher.
Oh, Libra. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Libra, yeah.
October?
October 2nd.
See, I was going, oh, God, you're October 2nd.
Okay. Just like everybody you know.
Wait a second. Wait a second.
We can't be friends. I'm sorry.
No, not me.
There's no room in the inn. My life is sort of bombarded with everyone that's a result of post-Valentine's Day activity.
Oh, that's that math. Good math. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that was some good math. You looked into that, huh?
Every, hey, man, drunken New Year's, Valentine's Day, early, literally, last of September, early October.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte, Fontigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Where were you born?
I was born in Huntsville Hospital. That's Huntsville, Alabama. I was raised in Athens, Alabama.
What was that town like?
It's changed a lot now, but back when I was little, it was lots of fields, cows, pastures. It's pretty flat where I live. So we got tornadoes, lots of country people. We have good diversity, though. Good diversity. Lots of rich people, poor people, Black folks, white folks, Mexican folks, all the folks.
You grew up cool. on a farm or like a cityscape? I'm asking this because I have ties to Alabama, so I'm trying to learn other parts of.
You mentioned that to me before.
Yeah.
But where I'm from is rural. It's pretty rural. I live way back off the road in the woods, and I grew up like kind of like in a farm setting. But also my father was he's a tow truck driver and he had a junkyard. So I kind of grew up like amongst junk, like a junkyard aesthetic, and also had like these beautiful animals running around.
So were you a loner or, you know, did you have a community of friends or?
So I just played with like, there was like little boys, like the neighborhood little boys, because I live way back in the country off the road. So they would literally just drive their little tractors down to my house and we would just play in the creek and stuff like that. Like it was like country.
Yo, is it just me? I just had this conversation with somebody the other day. You just made me think of this. Tomboys. That's not a term that's used anymore.
It's very not, but no. Back then it was.
It was. I was a tomboy. I mean, yeah. But I don't even know if it's politically correct anymore.
I don't know. I haven't thought about it in a long time.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. But I definitely was one of those. You know. And like my, you know, it was interesting, like my upbringing, like my dad, you know, he's a car salesman and he did, you know, the tow jobs and stuff like that. So he knew everybody in the community. So he would always do like what we call horse trading, which is just when you trade this for that. And I remember one time he brought me home a pony and I remember being so excited about this pony. I was the only girl on the street that had a little pony and the pony wasn't right in the head. So the pony would like try to attack us and chase us and bite us. It was eating meat.
It was eating what?
It was eating meat. It was eating birds.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I witnessed it.
Not your dream, My Little Pony.
Mm-mm. No, it was not a dream. But all the kids would come down and kind of check out the pony, you know. Yeah. So that was my claim to fame.
Now I'm going to ask you a round of dumb questions that I never asked a person that was anything close to equestrian life, because I don't know that many people that have owned horses or ponies or any of those things. And I hear this all the time where like one day I came home and my dad surprised me with, and usually a pony. What is the general like maintenance of owning one of those things? Like I have a farm now. Mm-hmm. Do mm-hmm. I plan on owning? And my farm actually comes with, I have like a barnyard that's mm-hmm. a stable that can hold six of them if I chose to own them. Right now mm-hmm. it's for storage, but what's the daily care routine for that?
Honestly, like when it comes to upkeep, for a horse, you're talking about, you got to have your like regular vet visits. You got to keep up with the vitamins. Definitely.
Wait, they take vitamins?
Yeah, well, it goes in the feed.
Why are you laughing at me, Laia?
Because they're beings. We all need nutrition.
You knew this?
I mean, I wasn't surprised.
Okay.
I'm not like an equestrian person, you know what I'm saying?
I didn't
like,
think I so either when he said
yeah,
it.
Yeah. But I remember what we used to do. You got to take care of the hooves. You got to take care of the coat. When it's cold outside, you got to make sure that everything's right for them. When it's hot outside, you got to make sure everything's right for them. Like, I'd say they're pretty high maintenance, really. And they're also expensive. They're expensive creatures.
You got to buy it a trailer, a mirror. Like, if you're going to take it to the vet, you got to take it to the vet.
Okay. Yeah. I just never understood, like, the casualness of friends of mine's like, yeah, I brought my kid a horse or whatever. But you know, I have anxiety trying to consider should I get a dog or not, let alone
then that's your answer. A horse are very different things.
Yeah, I'd start with a dog for sure.
Yeah,
dogs I'm not even starting with a dog because I travel too much. But, you know, I just generally wanted to know. And the neighbors that I have on both sides of the house, they have horses. I go up and pet it. And part of me thinks like, oh, it's not that bad. But I know that there's some real shit that I don't know. So.
And Brittany ain't say if she kept the pony until it turned into a horse. Did you?
That's the part I wanted to know. That's the part I wanted to know.
That's not how that works. Those are two different.
I did not know that. I thought that ponies were puppies to horses.
Nah, they're not. They're their own thing. Ponies do not turn into horses.
Wait, what? Wait,
the more you know. Here,
folks. Wait, what?
They do not turn into horses. Ponies is its own thing.
And they stay that size?
They stay that size. Yeah, they stay that size. That's right. Yeah. And they're kind of mean, to be honest with you. Ponies are not like super nice.
Really?
They got attitudes. All the ponies I've met have attitudes.
Even the Shetland ones? Like, real cute, like...
Oh, God, this is about to be our animated advertising thing, right?
Yeah. National Geographic with Questlove Supreme and Brittany Howard.
No, dude, this platform is more for me to learn shit more than go with their records. I already mentioned the record. I want to learn about this shit. How long did you keep the pony before it was like, okay, no more?
Not long. We kind of traded things up. So like,
and that's just common.
That's common around where I'm from. Yeah. And so we had traded, like, we had a quarter horse at first, and then we traded a quarter horse. The quarter horse is like 25 years old. So like, I couldn't do anything with it. So we traded it for the pony, and the whole reason we got the pony, cause the pony was mean, to bite you. So then I traded the pony for a go-kart, and then we were cool from then on.
Yes! No more horses. That's an awesome trade.
It's a good trade, yeah.
And what's this level of trading called again?
It's called horse trading.
Horse trading.
Okay, that's a term I never heard before. So is it a thing where, like, once a month you take what you want to trade to a place and you trade it, or you just go to your neighbor and be like, yo, what you want for this?
It's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I've been noticing that you have this in your yard. Does it run? Someone's like, well, it could run. I just ain't took it in. It's like, well, I got this. I'll trade you this for that. And then it's your job to get it running. And then you take that thing that now runs and you trade it for something else that you want. You know, you just trade up.
Okay. I got it now. Can you tell me what your first musical memory was?
Oh, man. First musical memory. My grandmother had like one of those big consoles that has like the 8-track player and the record player and the speakers built in. And I remember being really young, maybe 4, and messing around with all the vinyl.
Yes.
And pulling out some of the albums and had them all on the floor. And my grandma was like, what you doing? You know, like, don't break them and all this. And I remember her putting on the Thriller album.
Okay.
But I remember hearing the speakers, like, because it was like a tube system. I remember them warm up, and then I could hear, you know, songs of Thriller coming out of the speakers, and being like, "What the hell is this?" You know, mm-hmm. kind of amazed and enamored by the whole thing, not just the music, but just all of it. You know, the warmth of it coming on.
Was that your kind of, I don't mean come to Jesus moment, but for you, was that like the moment where it's like, okay, well, I want to also express myself in this way and through music? Or
no, not really. I mean, I had that kind of moment when I was 11. I was in middle school, and or am I middle school? I don't know, whatever grade 11 is, fifth or sixth mm-hmm. grade. Yeah. And there was a band from our school that had rented out our gym, and they were gonna put on a show. And I remember all throughout the day, everybody was asking, are you going to go to the show? Are you going to go to the show? I was like, I don't know. I'll see if I can get there. And so I get to the gym and I'm by myself. And I remember being like super anxious because I didn't really know anybody that well. And the band plays, and me seeing them play on stage, and it was kids I went to school with. It was like, I didn't know these kids could do this. They were so talented. Look at the effect they're having on people. It was songs that I liked and I knew. And it was like the coolest thing I had ever seen. And it was in that moment, standing in the gym, that I knew I wanted to be in a band and I wanted to make my own music and I wanted to be up there like they were. Like, I think that was the come to Jesus moment for me.
Okay. How long before you found other people that sort of had a common love for music? Like, was music something that you kept close to the chest, or like how big was the music community down there?
It was so small, I had to teach people how to play music to be in a band.
Wow.
So I would go teach myself the instruments, and then I would go back to school and I would just try to find a kid with some sort of musical talent, like rhythm. And I'd be like, okay, hey, do you want to learn how to play bass guitar? Or like, do you want to learn how to play drums? And I would tutor them and see if they get to a point where we can make music together. Some yes, but a lot no. Like, it just didn't happen.
Right.
I was trying to make it happen. And it wasn't until I was probably like 16 years old that I finally met some kids who also were interested in making music. And that was Zach Cockrell, bassist for Alabama Shakes. And then Keith Fogg, who became the guitar player. And it was them. So this whole thing really started from high school.
Was guitar your very first instrument of choice, or did you play other instruments as well?
My first instrument, I guess, technically is like piano, and then drums. I'm a drummer at heart. And then bass guitar.
You've never shared that with me.
Yeah. A lot of the drums on my new record, I programmed those drums.
Okay.
I'm not saying I could play them like that, but I can hear it, you know? Right. And then I learned bass, and then I only learned guitar because I had to. I didn't really want to play guitar.
Really?
No, I want to be in the rhythm section. I want to play bass.
What is the gap though? Wait, the gap in between you knowing you wanted to do this and you teaching folks that the music, like how are you learning? You never kind of said that yet. You just.
Yeah. So at first, like I didn't have those instruments. Like drums, I could have access to drums because there were a set of drums at our school. So I could go play those drums after school. When it came to bass guitar, I would just borrow one from one of the rich kids. Cause like, I don't know what it was about school, but all the rich kids had a bass guitar. hey, let me borrow it, you know, and they let me borrow it. And so I taught myself how to do that. And the guitar, my sister had a guitar like tucked away back in the closet. It was like one of those JCPenney guitars that looks like a Les Paul. And it's like 150 pounds. And that's what I learned on was that guitar. So I was teaching myself.
How long did it take? Oh, sorry.
I mean, I haven't mastered any of those instruments.
Girl, stop. All right, that's what we're doing. Okay.
No. Honestly, I was just learning as I went. So if I pick something up, I would make something with it. I would just learn as I went. So from the very beginning, I wanted to make my own music. That was like the whole goal. That was like the whole purpose. But when I was originally learning, I had to learn other people's songs. So I just started with stuff that was easy, like Blink-182. And all those like kind of things like that are pretty easy power chord stuff, you know.
So wait, I'm gonna ask you, am I the only one that goes through this? Like sometimes when we'll ask people about their childhood, you're thinking about your childhood too, but then you realize that their childhood is actually your adulthood. Like she's talking about her childhood in Blink 182, and I'm like, wait a minute, I was 33 years old when that came out. Like,
doing
what the
math.
Fuck, Brittany Howard?
Don't do the math.
Don't do it. It hurts.
I get my feelings hurt. I guess when we first played together was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, and we were doing a tribute for Big Mama Thornton. In your childhood, was there? Did anyone ever put you onto her, or was it like later in life when you discovered her? I'm for a so-called music historian. I admit, and I'm ashamed to admit that I was probably in my mid 40s before someone explained to me who Big Mama Thornton was, even though like I've heard Hound Dog and all that stuff all my life. But
I remember doing Sister Rosetta Tharpe though.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking you were talking about.
You know what?
Yeah,
I don't even want to edit that. Yes.
Yeah.
Even Questlove makes mistakes. Yes. I had a brain fart. I'm sorry.
Music historian Questlove.
We need to know both names.
We definitely need to know both names. I'm sorry. Yeah. I meant Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Yeah.
Were you at all familiar with her in your childhood, or did that come to you later in life?
It definitely came to me later in life. Maybe mid-20s. Mid-20s is when I started getting curious about these women blues players.
Right.
And then I had started hearing about, well, there's this woman that kind of inspired Chuck Berry and inspired Elvis Presley and had the electric guitar. And someone told me about it because I played an SG. And they're like, oh, that's like Sister Rosetta Tharpe. She also played an SG. She played an SG custom in white. And I was like, oh, I've never heard of her. So I started looking into her stuff. And I was like, the stuff she's actually playing on the guitar is so unique. It's her voice on that guitar. Nobody else is doing it. It's crazy. It's actually hard. It's hard to play how she's playing. And so that's when I kind of started diving into her stuff and her story, which her story is really interesting as well.
In your childhood or in your teens, who was your North Star by that point, as far as like singing was concerned, as far as like who's just like your go-to artist that you loved?
In my teens, it was David Bowie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because it was like the whole aesthetic and the songwriting. was like, it had like a lot of different mixtures in it, which I really liked. It had like some show tunes to it as well. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I could hear his inspirations being like from Broadway. And then like also he was taking things like from Kabuki theater, and he was borrowing rhythms from R&B and he was doing jazzy things. And it was just fascinating to me. And I liked his voice. I thought it was really interesting how he used his voice too. He wasn't trying to be like a professional singer, a technical singer. It was just, he was just like giving, like he was giving vignettes. He was giving like small scenes from a movie or something every song. And I thought that was cool. So I became obsessed with it.
Okay.
Obsessed to what levels?
I had everything. I had everything he had ever done.
You have Labyrinth?
Yes. I was just about, I love you, Fonte.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, she said Bowie, I was like, okay, what era of Bowie is this? You know, early, is this 84?
Literally
Bowie, like.
Oh, I was listening to like Tin Man. I was listening to all of it. I didn't like it, but Tin Man? I listened to it. Yeah, I was. Yeah.
You know, it's weird. All right, so I worked in a record store 88, 89 when the first Tin Man album came out. And okay, so we traded in the record store for the internet, but if you hang out in a record store long enough, you're going to meet two or three know-it-all snobs that have their like unsolicited opinions on stuff, and suddenly their opinions become your opinions. And working in that record store, and like, think of Jack Black's character in
High Fidelity.
Yeah, like I had like two of those guys, and you know, we had to put the Tin Men display up and all that stuff, and they were just like, ah, man, this shit sucks. And of course, you know, everyone, once you go back to when, you know, your first 7 years when you're blowing everyone's mind, and when it was just your secret before the world had you. And it's so weird because I'm working on this doc right now, and Timmons performance, I will say that if you really give, and if you could find any of their performances online, and I don't know how much they did, I know they did a few promotional shows and whatnot, but I would almost say that Tin Man was almost like a precursor to grunge. Yeah, I mean, if I can borrow from Gen Z, it was giving down. it was giving Soundgarden. It was giving Alice in Chains. It was borderline. It was somewhere in between like early Smashing Pumpkins. And I know when we say grunge, you just automatically, non-grunge heads will just think like, oh, Smells Like Teen Spirit, or, you know, that sort of thing. But I mean, yeah, like I realized that, oh, Bowie's fan base had the younger generation after the same thing with Prince. If you remember that Prince got booed at the Rolling Stones, opening for the Rolling Stones back in 81, like baby boomers were not Prince's audience. Prince was the older brother of Gen X. So, you know, some 3 or 4 years later, that audience is going to grasp to Prince. And yeah, it's weird that even I would say that all Bowie fans should probably revisit Tin Man, or at least try to find them in concert. It was actually awesome. Like, if you're a fan of grunge, I would say that they're the precursor to that. So, but that's my opinion.
All right, y'all, you know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Anyone else besides Bowie?
Let's see. Started off pretty hard with David Bowie. And then I found out about Pink Floyd. I hadn't heard Pink Floyd before. I remember being like, it was like 15, riding in the back of my friend's car. And she starts playing, Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the hell is this? This is so many different types of music.
Right.
This is like jazz. This is like, well, I'd never heard any type of music like it. Right. I remember hearing it in the back of a Buick LaSalle. I remember hearing it, and I remember getting so excited because I didn't know you could do music like that. I didn't know you could take everything like that and mix it together.
Without psychedelics?
No psychedelics. I was just getting a ride home from school.
Oh, wow. That's what's up. Have you ever done the Wizard of Oz test to it?
No, I've never done that. I've heard about it.
Have you heard about it?
I've heard about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's up until maybe the end of Money, it literally...
It really does.
If it's perfect.
Is the Wizard of Oz test, I thought that was for The Wall and not Dark Side.
Nah, Dark Side, on the third line roar, you're supposed to start the record on the third line roar of MGM, and literally it plays perfectly. Even when it turns into color, that's when the bells and money starts.
Money.
And they start doing the dance and all that stuff. And then towards the end, it's like, okay, now he definitely did it up until Money. I'll say that much. Have you ever watched The Wall?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I first saw The Wall The Wall was the first pandemic film that I watched I started obsessing over Fantasia. And I don't know, man. I it's almost like we owe Roger an apology letter, because I know that, you know, for all intents and purposes, like, we credit Michael Jackson for video innovation. But for that thing to come out in 1979, which is basically pretty much, you know, if you were to take like the 15 best videos you've seen on MTV for the first 4 years, like between 81 and 85, then I would say like The Wall was all that in 1979, and he just never truly got the credit. Like, again, I discovered The Wall in 2020, like long after that fact. So I highly recommend it. But
I mean, yeah. And when I was in high school, that was like a cult classic. Like, you had to sit down and watch The Wall. We all knew it was something special, and everybody was, you know, trying to experiment with drugs and watch The Wall, and we're at a party, The Wall's on. Like, that was like the cool thing, you know?
Yep. I recommend it. You know, before 2020, I really wasn't big on drinking or psychedelics at all. Like an occasional cookie or gummy or that sort of thing. But, you know, most people said like you should experience it outside. I'm still not an outside person. I want to be inside when I do it, because I don't know, fear of control or whatever. But someone suggested to me to watch Fantasia. And there's two versions. There's Fantasia and then Fantasia 2, which came out in 2000. Without psychedelics, you'll see something in that movie. But with it, oh my God, it's a whole nother level of, like, I use that pretty much. I'd watch it like once, maybe twice a week, while kind of making, and then after that, I would get ideas for Summer of Soul. Like, oh, why don't I do this and that and this and that? And kind of the panic level of Summer of Soul's editing, I would say, was really inspired just by like ideas I had from doing that. Sometimes you have to get into someone else's art in order to create your own. I want to ask, so did you start Bermuda Triangle before the Alabama Shakes?
No, that was after.
Okay, after. So Alabama Shakes was your first group. Can you talk about the formation of that?
So I was in high school and I had been looking for people to play with, and I seen a couple of guys in my school that were interested in music, playing music, and they were like dedicated to it. And so I really wanted to meet them. I was trying to figure out, so I'm younger than them. And me being me, I was like, why would they want to talk to me? Like, I'm younger than them. I look different than them. We don't travel in the same groups. I don't know how I'm going to have my end. So I went and made a little demo like by myself. Mm-hmm. And I used to use like Audacity. So it's like super easy to record with, sounded terrible back in the day. And so I brought him a CD and I was like, hey, this is to Zach, bass player, who mm-hmm. later became the bass player of Alabama Shakes. I was like, hey, I made this music. I don't know. I just wonder if you ever want to come like jam with me sometime, play music with me sometime. He was like, yeah, let's go listen to it. So we go to the parking lot of the high school, sit in his Honda Accord, and he plays it. And he's like, oh, this is cool. He's like, yeah, I'd like to come over and play. So that's a spot when I was like 15, 16, and me and Zach started playing every day. And we were learning how to play, like, at the time it was like prog rock. So we're like doing Yes and King Crimson. We're like learning that kind of stuff. This is new to me, but mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by it because it's all really technically difficult stuff. And we started writing together and then we made a demo. And Heath, who later became a guitar player for the Shakes, heard that and was like, I want y'all to open, like, can y'all open for my band? And I was like, man, we don't even got a band. It's just like us. So we went down to the music store and the best drummer in town worked at the music store. We only had one music store in town. Mm-hmm. Hey man, you want to come play with us? He's like, oh, I don't know. We show him our demo. He's like, I'll check it out. I'll come by. I'll see what y'all are about. So then we start playing together. And then we opened up for Heath's group. And honestly, that's like what did it. The first time we played together, we knew that we had something. And so we started then working on our own material. And that later became the Alabama Shakes, the four of us.
I got hip to you guys via Jack White. It was pretty much like, you know, screaming from the mountaintops about you guys and whatnot. For you, did you have any expectations of where this journey was going to take you in terms of like...
I'm trying, from the time we started a band, which I'm saying we started a band when I probably had just graduated high school, 2007. Mm-hmm. I'd say like that's really when we started playing our own shows with our own music. And then I feel like whenever Boys and Girls came out, it was like 2012.
It's like 2011. Like yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't that long, but we played all the time and we played for no money. And all we did was get together Tuesdays and Thursdays and write new music, work on the set. To me, it was like miraculous that anything happened at all. Cause at a certain point, I just like accepted that I was going to be a mail carrier. I was going to deliver mail and I'll play music on the side and that was going to be my life. I was okay with that.
Well, let me ask, because I'm curious about band dynamics, like anyone being a band or a unit in, you know, post millennial times, it's almost like it's like aliens landing because, you know, pretty much life is built for the solo artist post 2000. When the band is forming, is there a general agreement like of who the leader is, or is it like a thing where it's like, okay, it's democracy and we all have a say, or like, how do you handle band decisions and whatnot? Like, how do you deal with those dynamics?
For us, it was a democracy. That's we honestly communicated a lot why or why not we shouldn't do something.
Right.
And the better you were at just talking about your feelings, usually the more
what's that?
The more it will go your way, because the better you were at communicating why you didn't want to do this. Mm. It was almost like in a court of law, but it came from an emotional place. I really don't want to do this because XYZ, this is cheesy, this is that, this is yeah. You know, if you were quieter, you didn't get as much of your way because it's like nobody's hearing what you have to say. But we would all sit down and talk. You know,
okay. I would assume that the reception of Boys and Girls was not overwhelming, but it was definitely, you know, to come out the gate. And I'm speaking as a person that took four attempts to finally mm-hmm. come out the gate. What is it like on your debut to come out the gate and instantly become
home run
critical darlings? And what is that feeling?
Surreal. So absolutely surreal.
Can you describe like the first moment when you realize like, oh shit, we're really going to be a thing.
Yeah, I do. I do remember it. It popped in my head as soon as you said it. I remember it was in Nashville. We're on Broadway. And there's like the secret club. I don't know. I don't know anything about that life. We had just got through playing the Blue Room with Jack White. Jack White invited us to play his Third Man Records. Right. And I was excited to meet Jack White because I love the White Stripes. Right. And then the Kings of Leon is there. And I, at the time, like I had like the first two records, loved Kings of Leon. Mm-hmm. And they're coming up to me and they're like, oh, you know, I think you're gonna make it, like all this stuff, you know.
Right.
And I'm like, these guys are telling me I'm gonna make it. And so I remember going to the secret little bar after the show, and you know, it was kind of fancy. I'd never been in that environment before. And I remember there's a balcony outside, and it was me and the drummer Steve. And I go out there, and Steve was crying. And I was like, I looked at him, I was like, why are you crying, Steve? He was like, I really think we're going to do something. And I was like, damn, you think so? And then I started crying. And we're just out there just having this emotional moment. That's like, I can't believe this is happening to us. It was just all of our circumstances. It was just like such a miracle happening in our lives. It was just like, it's like Superman came in to save you, you know?
Right, that's when you needed it, huh?
It's like right on time. So much of my life at the poverty line. And now I had an opportunity for the first time ever, you know?
So,
and that's what it felt like.
You all collectively moved to Nashville, or?
No, I was the first one to move to Nashville, and that was later. It was like much later, yeah. Okay. I stayed in Athens for a long time.
I'm being told that Nashville is pretty much the last bastion of hope for the serious musician. Is it that, like, every singer-songwriter I know, especially now, like, I peeped one person's Instagram feed, and suddenly, you know, like, when you peep one Instagram feed, your algorithms was suddenly, I didn't realize the staggering amount of songwriters. And I just thought like, oh, it must be just country. No, it's every musician is like, I got to go to Nashville to make it. The way that an actress is like, I got to go to Hollywood to make it.
Yeah.
What is it about Nashville that just calls out, not even a musician, you? What is it? What is it?
For me, it was a practical thing. Nashville Airport goes a lot of different places. That's really all it was. Like, and I had, you know, when I moved there initially, so I'm from a small town. Nashville was kind of like, besides Birmingham, that was the next biggest town. That's where you could go see the bands you want to see. You could go see live music. So I was always going up there to go see bands. And so I made friends up there. So naturally, I wanted to go to be where my friends were. So that's how I ended up in Nashville. But I stay in Nashville because it's practical. Like, my family's an hour and a half away. The airport's 15 minutes away. Now I have good friends in the city. And that's, I mean, I'm not going to say I get out there and watch a lot of music. I don't.
Really?
I'm kind of a homebody.
Just want to say congratulations, Brittany Howard. You've continued a long tradition of Questlove Supreme antics where I will romanticize something. And then
and you'll shut
my
it down.
Interview subject just takes this and does this.
But there is a beauty to Nashville. I've never been there in my whole life up until the last 5 years because they have the Black Music Museum now in Nashville, which I'm on a small board for. But also witnessing like Black Americana and some of those bands and the rise of like Black folks claiming their country again is a beautiful. It's beautiful.
It is beautiful. And I do love that about Nashville. And I actually love the younger people that live there now and the music that they're doing. It's actually really exciting. We got like house clubs now. Well, I don't know if I should say that, but like we have house parties now.
And y'all like, know what else? Brittany is
not
okay.
House music, but actual house.
Yeah.
Joint meaning or.
Well, it's like, you know, everything they do is legal. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. No. I thought you meant house music. I was like, oh, club culture is coming to Nashville. I get it.
No, that is what I'm saying. That is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And they get their own speaker systems together and it's cool. It's like really cool. It's really lively. I'll go to that, but not for long because I like to sleep nowadays, but like I'll go for a couple hours. You know what I mean? And there's that happening in Nashville. That's cool. And there's a part of me that almost wants to gatekeep it to keep it pure. Because Nashville, you have to keep in mind, it's also a tourist town. But we also have to live in a tourist town.
So you don't want me coming colonizing your precious Nashville.
Listen, Amazon already moved to Nashville, honey. It's official. It's gone.
It's over. It's over. Oracle's moving in. It's over. We got Topgolf.
Hey, don't front on Topgolf.
What you know about Topgolf, Amir?
Yeah.
I'm a human being, Lightyear. I do.
He's a golfer.
What do I know about Topgolf? Lightyear, what human being do you know will invite every walk of life to a game night?
Like, that's true.
I'm Dr. Game Night. Of course I know Topgolf.
From the bowling. We used to do the bowling 20 years. You got to keep it going. Yeah. I got it.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories, change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
I will ask, at its height, was there a moment when, and again, my obsession with how people can create and do bands together, the same questions I asked Fonte with Little Brother, is there a moment where it stops being fun? Or, you know, when you released your first solo record, I was like, uh-oh, like, because often when people release a solo record, I'm hoping that they realize that you can go off and do separate projects, but you can always come back to home base and keep the brand alive, or keep my dream alive. I won't say the dream, but you know.
Yeah, because you and me.
Well, yeah, because I want to see more bands in existence. So in a way that you can express it without it being awkward, what was the decision that led up to breaking up the band?
We have been working incredibly hard for a long number of years, and it came to a point where people got to go home and live their lives, but I never really got to live my life because I was working on the next album,
right?
Or I was doing this, I was doing that, and it's just like I was just tired, and it was like a hard decision because like those are my brothers, you know what I'm saying? Like, we all of our lives experienced this miracle at the same time. We saw the world together, and we created beautiful things together. It was really difficult to choose myself. I'll be honest.
Right.
It was difficult to take care of my own mental, spiritual, emotional health. But it was a choice I made because I wasn't enjoying creating. Nothing was coming to me. I was just kind of tired of the whole business. It was like I didn't even like music no more. You know what I mean? It's just like, I think it was just overworked. And it was the kind of situation where it's like, even if I took a break, I don't know if I would have come back. You know what I mean? It's nobody's fault. It's just conditional. Yeah.
I would think that would actually be more of a business or more of a burden now that everything's going to fall on you. Like, I'm certain that as a solo artist, yes, you could complete autonomy in terms of how you sonically want stuff to sound or songs you want to do or whatever control that it is that you want or musically how you want it to sound. But I would figure that it's even more of a burden that way. For you, was it a matter of like song choices, what you wanted to do or how you wanted some of the sound or arrangements or level of musicianship? Like, what was it about being a solo artist that made you say, look, this is the end of the road and I have to do this now?
I think what you're saying is part of it. It's all kind of part of it. Wanting to hear what it sounds like if I create something without anybody editing it is part of it. Like, what if I can just do this on my own? What if I can just write music like this on my own? I need the right recipe. I need the right parts. It's like, it's just a freedom, a creative freedom. And I thought, well, like, life is short. I think it's worth giving that a shot, giving that a chance, see what I can do with it. That's part of it. And as far as like having a burden, being a solo artist, I just feel like there's not as much of a burden as you would think, because at the end of the day, when I don't want to do this anymore, I'm not like having to affect other people's lives like as much as I was in the Shakes. Like, if I said I don't want to tour this year, that's affecting all of them. And what if I don't want to go back out? That's affecting all of them all of the time. So you're kind of tied together. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And when you're on your own, it's like the ship sinks or the ship sails. Like, and it's all up to me. So
you.
It's a different type of fulfillment. You know what I mean?
I'd like to know, because you were an intersectional and interracial band. How hard is it to get people to understand culturally where you're coming from when you're kind of alone, but still in a crowd of people? Like, is it easy to explain things? Are they sensitive to these things? Or was it always a teachable lesson? And not even with your bandmates, but just in, as you guys are operating as a band.
I think that's a good question. It's like nothing we ever really had to talk about. It was just, this is me. This is my expression. This is how I feel about this. We never really had to have conversations. Because by the time, like when we were talking about the band, by the time the band kind of concluded, we had all grown a lot in a lot of different ways. And it had kind of got to the point where I was just like, well, I don't want any of my expressions to affect you or vice versa. How I feel about something shouldn't affect you, and how you feel about something should, you know, it started to become a little bit more like, some of us were different. That's all. Yeah. We just grew into different people. Difference. Yeah.
You worked on Sound and Color with one of my favorite producers, Blake Mills. Can you describe what that process was like working with him?
Sure. Yeah, there were some songs. So usually when I come to the studio, I have everything already demoed out, like how I want it to sound, and it don't sound good yet, but it's just the ideas there. Mm-hmm. And I'll have all the parts laid out. And there was a few songs I just couldn't seem to get finished. You know, working with Blake was cool because we both just put our heads together and tried to figure out where we can take this thing. And one of the songs, you know, I had like, it's called a song called The Greatest. Mm-hmm. And it was like a slow kind of ballad thing.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, just speed it up. There you go. There it was. Now it's like this punk rock thing. And it was really cool. It was like a Ramones type thing. And mm-hmm. I liked that. And then there was like, obviously getting the sounds and tones, and we're working with Sean Everett. And we were, all of us were like a part of that process, especially like the mixing and finding the different sounds. And then I think for like the final song, finishing some of the lyrics to Gemini, finishing lyrics to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the process was like, having Blake work with you is like, it's nice to have someone like light a fire underneath you and keep you on task. Because I feel like sometimes as songwriters, musicians, having an idea and finishing it is a whole
thing.
It's a whole thing. Yeah.
Yep.
Could you talk about what the process was like producing your own records, like being in total control of it and kind of using that as your, not soapbox or pulpit, like that being your confessional kind of project? Can you explain just the process of making the Jamie record?
Yeah, it was actually kind of a supernatural process, to be honest with you. I went to Topanga in it's like that mountain outside LA. Mm. And it's got like they say there's hippies there. I didn't meet any. But
right.
I rented this house and I had like 3 songs. And I knew that I think it was like 3 weeks, a month, I had to go into the studio and I had to record, and I didn't have anything and I wasn't getting anything. Like, right. I don't smoke weed, but I like went and bought some weed. And I sat down and I was like, I gotta connect with the muse. I have to get inspired. I don't have anything. So I called a psychic. And the psychic was like, oh, you already got, she's like, you already got it in the bag. The record's already done. I was like, what do you mean? She's like, you already have the songs. You just got to find them. I was like, that doesn't make any sense. So now I'm miserable because I don't waste the money on the psychic.
Mm-hmm.
But I have 4 songs. And I go to the studio and I tell Sean, I don't know, this is what I got. Let's get the band in here. Let's do these. And maybe as the days go by, I'll find time to create some new ones. I don't know. As we would sit down with the band, have lunch, we'd have these conversations. And then they would just say like a particular word. Like one of the words was Jehovah's Witness. And I had remembered right when they said it, oh my God, I have a project in Logic called Jehovah's Witness. And it was cool. Cause I name my projects like whatever. Cause uh-huh. I have to name them before I can save them on my system. Mm-hmm. So I had to get someone all the way back in Nashville to send me entire projects. And that's how I got the album together. It would be every day going in and someone would just say a phrase and I'd be like, that's a song. Now I have the song Baby. Now I have the song Goathead. And all these things were getting pulled in. And like, it just came together like that. It was crazy. It's like I did already have them.
So the psychic was right.
The psychic was technically correct, yes.
What was the inspiration? Because actually, to be honest, I forgot where I was, but I Shazammed something. I heard Sid the Kid singing, and I Shazammed it, and I realized I didn't know at the time that you actually remixed the Jamie album or had a slew of people from Ninth Wonder and Georgia Ann and Bad Not Good
Childish Gambino, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Glover that's worked right. on a joint too. Mm-hmm. Right. So I got deep into that. What was the process of doing that? Because it was almost like a whole new album.
Yeah. The process was like, first things first, I just want to reach out to people whose music and ideas I really respect. What if y'all wanted to remix one of these songs real quick? What would it sound like if you did it? And honestly, like everybody was super excited to do it. And every time a new song would come in, I would get so excited. And I'd run out to my car and I'd just sit there and listen to him be blown away. Like Little Dragon did some stuff. Freddie Gann did some stuff. Michael Kiwanuka did some stuff. Uh-huh. And this is just like people I've always like kind of wanted to work with. And this is kind of an easy way to get to work together. The overall, the song and the material is already there. Just rearrange it. Like, how would you have done it? And it was so interesting to listen to. It was so cool. Mm-hmm. Such a cool project.
It reminded me of like the Verve remix projects. Like you just did your own right. your album. Yeah, it's really dope.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, you talked about a lot of things self-care wise in this conversation. I'm curious how it's evolved now that you are by yourself and you have to figure out all of these, you know, everything has changed in the dynamic. Although you have this whole next level of freedom, you also mm-hmm. have a next level of attention. So what does that, yeah, responsibility, like Fonte mm-hmm. said, like, so what does self-care on a daily look like for you?
On the daily, I do meditation. I do transcendental meditation. So I've been doing that for, I guess, a couple years.
Yeah.
Helps a lot.
How much time? How much time do you spend on it?
That's 20 minutes twice a day.
TM Small.
So. Yep.
That's why I was late to this joint.
Oh, okay. Excused.
Well, that creates, you know, it's amazing what it does. It creates a lot of space in my life. I got one of mine that runs all day. And when I lay down, I don't want to stop running, you know? So that's really helpful and gives me patience for anything that I come up against. It gives me space for people who love me and who I want to take care of. Helps me be a better performer because I'm not overwhelmed, not stressed out all the time. Because it's, you know, it just can be very stressful.
You have anxiety performing?
No, I don't have anxiety performing. But you know, performing to me is really, it's the pinnacle of what I do. Like, I love making records. I also love performing. And when I perform, I really do try my best, man. And like, it's the point where I get to be free. Like, in my physical form, I get to be free. Nobody can touch me. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is my space. This is my thing.
We feel that.
Yeah. And I spend, like, when I'm on tour now, I just spend all of my time making sure I'm ready for that thing. You know, that's the most important thing when I'm out here.
I want to ask, you work on this new record with a good buddy of mine, Nate Smith.
Drummer. Yeah, Nate.
What's it like collaborating with him, and how'd you guys meet and start working together?
So I love Nate. I'm a drummer at heart. I love drummers, right? I've been a fan of you, Questlove, for a very, very long time. You and
Anna Hoops.
Yeah. Very long time. Of course. And I started to see Nate, and I started to see the way he played. And I thought the way he played was so interesting because it's so emotional. Of course, it's super technical, but there's also just so much feeling in it when he's playing. And I just started watching all his videos, and I thought to myself, before I made the album Jamie, if I'm going to get any drummer to play on this, who would it be? And I just, because I had just found him and it just kind of broke off into watching his videos, I was like, I'm just going to ask him. I'm just going to ask Nate. Let's see if he'll do it. And he said yes, came to the studio, we made that album together. And then I was like, will you go on the road with me? And I had to do a little convincing. We didn't know each other that well. He said yes. And now I get to play with him like every night, all the time. He's just incredible. He's just incredible. Incredible. I feel like the luckiest person. I get to be on stage with someone like a musician like that.
Does he only play three drums on the road? It's like he has like a kick, a snare, and a hi-hat. That's like his shit. It's like the Questlove method. It's like all you need, right? Does he have more drums on the road?
Not during my show. We got him playing.
Oh, okay.
Yes. He got two kick drums, two toms, two snares, wow. SPD pad. Yeah.
All of it. That's good.
Hey, Brittany, can I ask you about the visuals for this album, or at least for the single?
Sure.
And tell me about, like, I'm just curious too, because again, you on your solo joint. So tell me about what you just how it even came to fruition, and to the album cover, because what we're seeing today is not how you perform as well. It's like a whole.
So for the visuals for the album cover, I really like movies. I really like Japanese movies and Korean movies, and I like Akira Kurosawa, and Akira Kurosawa's got this movie called Dreams. And I never hear people really talking about it, but it's the most beautiful movie. And the things he was trying in that film are incredible, colorful, unique storylines. You kind of show up and you're supposed to just know what's going on. It's like all this like folklore. And at the same time, he's weaving in his own life story. And it's all just very deep and metaphorical. And I was very inspired by that visual element, like the visual elements from that film. And so when I went to do my album cover, I wanted it to feel kind of like a dream, where it's like you're sitting in a place that is seemingly like very beautiful and very comfortable, but in truth, there's like a storm in the background and there's rattlesnakes and the flowers and it's 20 degrees outside. Because that was the reality. Damn. The reality was, that's not AI. I woke up at 2:20 a.m. to drive
that's
out to the mountains.
AI?
That's not AI. No, that's AI. That's real, real, real.
And then the video.
And then the video for What Now?
Yes.
Yeah. So the song What Now, it kind of reminds me of like Michael Jackson. It kind of reminds me of like this nostalgia from when I was a kid, like RoboCop. I don't know, like
laughing.
Yeah, just like the Vaseline on the lens effect. Like, so that's what I wanted to give it. I wanted to give it this kind of like Matrix, like ninja, like RoboCop, like just aesthetic to it. Because the song to me,
because you're hardly in it.
No, I don't like being in music videos. It takes too long.
Smart. Like, that's the Aerosmith way.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you gotta change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? Well, no, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house.
So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work and traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, what was it like to record at Sound Emporium? For those that don't know, Sound Emporium in Nashville is like a legend fucking dairy studio owned by RCA Records. Like all the greats have recorded there. I was surprised it's still up and operational and running. And my B side of that question is, how did you wind up with Prince's board?
Yeah, Sound Emporium is great. You know, first and foremost, I want a real chamber, like wherever I'm recording. They got one of those. Uh-huh. I want a big room because I want to be able to position mics wherever I need to. Or if I have like a binaural mic in the center room, I want to be able to space things out as far as I want to. If I want to throw my voice, I can be in a corner room. I got plenty of space to do this. I got plenty of space to do whatever you want. So that's one of the things I love about Sound Emporium. And they already got all the gear you need. They got the tape machines. You know, you're not calling in and bringing in stuff. They got a lot of the, they have a great board. I think they just got like a, they used to have a Neve board, which I really, really, really liked. But now they got this API board. It's nice too. It's good. I like it. Yeah. So Sound Emporium, shout them out. I'll keep going there as long as they'll have me. I love it there. It's like home away from home at this point.
Nice.
Now, when it comes to Prince's console,
yeah,
it didn't belong to Prince himself. This has been getting all over the world. It's like a game of telephone.
Chris Moon.
So Prince, you know, he recorded his first album twice. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was like in the Bay Area. This board had been in Minneapolis, but it's an MCI board. But the fellow who had it wanted to take it to the Bay Area with him. So he took it from Minneapolis to, like, I don't know, somewhere around San Francisco. The album got recorded. The first time Prince did it, he said he didn't like it. He, you know, we all know that story because the other musicians were playing. So then he scrapped that. And where he went and recorded the actual album was a different board. So that's just the providence of it. And the fella who had took it to there then took it to Nashville. And that's how it got in Nashville. And that's how I got a hold of it. Of course, when I paid for it, I didn't buy it because it was Prince's board. I just saw this like MCI board with the MCI tape machine that comes together kind of moment. And I was like, yeah, I want that.
There's, I forget the studio it was, but when Jill Scott first moved to Nashville, we shot the video for whatever the first single was of her album in a studio. And coincidentally, the API board that recorded the Purple Rain record and subsequently Around the World in a Day is also in Nashville. And I'm like, wow, why is Nashville becoming the landing spot for all of Prince's gear? So
that's interesting.
Have you ever recorded in Jack White's studio or went there or
Third Man?
Third Man?
Yeah.
I think the Shakes did some like singles over there at Third Man.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've also been to his place. He has a studio at his place too. And I went over there a long time ago and did a couple singles with him. Yeah.
Brittany, how much stuff like these days is it are you doing that are digital based versus analog based? It seems like this, what you're just talking about chambers and binaural mics seems very analog to me, but like some of the sounds seem very digital. I don't know. Like where, what do you do? Are you consciously like making decisions based on that kind of thing? Or is it just kind of all, just all a bunch of paint and you're just painting with all of it?
So when I start off doing my demos, it's usually digital just because it's handy. I can pull from lots of different ideas really quickly. So I'll start there, but I know ultimately I want to do something analog. To me, and you know, everybody has an opinion about this, but to me, the analog is just more fun because you can accidentally do shit with analog that is just because there's a wiring problem. Or this one sounds different than that one. Why is that? It's just like there's something to it. There's something in the wiring, in the circuitry, in the tubes. And then putting everything down to tape just kind of is like a nice way of smooshing everything together. It's such a small detail, but I really do think I can feel and hear the difference. And personally, when I'm making music, it's more fun. It's just more fun.
All right, before we wrap up, I don't want to be intrusive, but you did bring it up. Can you share with me what your mantra word is in your TM?
I can't. You know I can't.
Ah, come on.
I'm not gonna tell you that word.
Can you share what the hell that means?
Yeah, all right. So when you do TM, like
transcendental meditation. Okay.
Yeah, yes. So all right, when I first got introduced to meditation, of course was in the pandemic, and I felt the world was fucking coming to an end. So I became like a meditation obsessive. I was going about it all wrong. Like I would do like 2 hours to 2.5 hours in the morning before I get out of bed of anything. DMT meditate, like every type of breath of fire, all that stuff. And then I do an additional 2 hours before I go to bed. And a friend was like, wait, you meditate 4 hours a day?
Yeah. How do you have that time?
I was, the world stopped.
Pandemic, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, all I had was DJing for 5 hours and working a bit on Summer Soul, but I was doing nothing. And I was just like, I need to keep my sanity. And they were basically like, all right, that's cute, but you're doing it wrong. And you really... And so he gave me a clip. Weird enough, Jerry Seinfeld has a clip on YouTube of all people in the world. And he's like, the key to my success is... TM, trance meditation. And, you know, I met him maybe 7 months later and I asked him about it. I was like, so what did you mean the key to your success? And he's like, well, we were break for lunch on Seinfeld. And instead of me going to lunch, in 45 minutes, I'll go to my trailer and I'll do TM for like maybe 10 to 15 minutes. Always. And then I'll go about my day. And I was like, well, I don't get it. 10 minutes? I do 4 hours. And he started laughing like, you're doing it wrong. And so basically, there's a gentleman named Bob Roth who I got put on to. And what it is that you're assigned a word and you're supposed to keep that word unique to yourself. I've talked to some people and, you know, we trade off words, whatever. But yes, you're supposed... You're supposed to keep it to yourself and you're basically supposed to sit. So I sit in this office and I sit in the dark and pretty much you say your mantra or your chant. If you remember What's Love Got to Do with It.
Nam Young Ho Ring and Kill. Nam Young Ho.
Right, exactly. Or if you're a fan of What's Happening Now. All right, I'm joking about What's Happening, but yeah, I mean, even. You know, that's words, but some people just sit and hum. Sometimes I get lazy and don't do the chant, and I'll just sit. And what it does, it just basically, if you live a life in which you got to make panic decisions with seconds left on the clock, like I live in a constant state of panic where it's, you know, I owe this guy a deadline and that deadline, and where's your notes from da 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 da. And you're 10 minutes later, and that sort of thing. So sometimes you just got to sit for 10 minutes in silence. It's what keeps your sanity. Because if you don't do that, you're going to drink. I need a drink. I need something. You know, so I'd rather when I get to the place. And, you know, even though we were talking before we started recording. I had probably one of the most stressful nights of my life last night. So I had to do therapy and TM, like old school Amir, like an hour. So it's the thing that keeps you from making rash decisions that will affect the rest of your life, or unfortunately for some people in their life. So with that said, I actually want to, you know, thank you, especially with the way that the album is crafted with the interludes and, you know, in the same vein of as what Andre's doing with his project. Like, I love the fact that post-pandemic times we're getting new versions of Black artistry, because oftentimes, like, we're very close to the chest when it comes to being vulnerable and letting our feelings out there and sharing with people. So yeah, congratulations on doing that. It's really inspirational. And thank you for doing the show with us, Britt.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Congratulations on freedom.
Man, appreciate that. Thank you.
We can can see it and hear it on you, your freedom. Yeah. It's awesome. I'm taking some of it. Thank you.
And I appreciate that, because I know, like, this process of people just probing into your life and all those things is the part of the music biz that is the most uncomfortable, where we just want to sing and whatnot. But thank you. It's good to give somebody their flowers that's just as uncomfortable as I am with taking it. So
and happy Women's History Month, because you're always making history in my book. This voice is historic.
And absolutely. That too. Hey, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Yeah.
All right. So on behalf of Fontigolo, Laia, and Sugar Steve, and brand new Bill. That's right. I got to give you a new.
I got a nickname every day. All right, I'll take brand new.
Oh, I'm sorry, Superior. We got new monikers, Laia.
Oh, for Bill.
Brand new Bill and Superior.
Upgraded again.
Superior Steve.
Superior Steve. I love it.
Yes.
Bill and Brittany y'all done the street together.
Brittany's never been on the street. I don't think.
Brittany, you ain't been on the street.
Damn, we got Brittany on the street.
I can work on that.
She's perfect for the street.
Yes. Yeah.
She's just perfect in general. But
I mean,
too.
That's true. Okay.
All right. I'll take that today. Hey, thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. We got you. Thank you.
All right. So until the next time, ladies and gentlemen, this was Questlove Supreme. We'll see you on the next go round. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Questlove Supreme, hosted by Amir Questlove Thompson, Aya St. Clair, Fonte Coleman, Sugar Steve Mandel, and unpaid Bill Sherman. Executive producers are Amir Questlove Thompson, Sean G, and Brian Calhoun. Produced by Brittany Benjamin, Cousin Jake Payne, and Laia St. Clair. Edited by Alex Conroy. Produced by iHeart by Noel Brown.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.